right.
Okay, so this is Bio 231, and it is February 10th. We're going to get into the integumentary system, or integument, today. And you got to know what that means. Who knows what the integument means? Oh, we're missing a screen here, huh? Maybe I'll get it on. Okay, so it's skin. And also some accessory structures that we always find with skin. There's some muscle, and of course you're familiar with hair and nails, and some glands, and you're familiar with glands. All right, so the schedule right here. When's your first, who's on a Monday, when's your first practicum? On the 24th, right there. All right, so we don't have a lecture exam and a practicum on the same day, but sometimes we do. Sometimes we do, so you got to pay attention to that. All right, so integument today, and on Wednesday, we're going to look at some bones and skeletal tissue, and then that's everything for the first exam. And, of course, you got study guides for all of these things, and hopefully you've been working on those ahead of time so that lectures make a whole lot of sense, and labs will be a lot easier if you look at if you start working on those study guides early. All right, don't start on President's Day holiday because you think you have all day to study. It won't matter if you start studying on that day, right? You're just not enough time for everything to sink in, right? So now is the time to get started for that first exam. Okay, so are there any questions on histology or tissues or cells or body planes? No? Okay, looking good. All right, so I'll put this away. And, all right, so integumentary system. It is composed of skin and accessory structures like hair, nails, glands, and muscle. These are just some things that help skin do its job. And what the heck, what kind of job is that? All right, so we want to understand the structure because we want to understand the function. All right, so one of the most important functions is protecting internal structures from bacteria and fungi and viruses. Right, so any kind of infectious agent, but probably even more important, it protects us from dehydrating. We probably dehydrate, maybe it wouldn't even take a minute, maybe about a minute. We'd lose so much water without our skin, we just turn into a potato chip, and then that would be the end of us. All right, so it's a nice saran wrap. It keeps our body water inside of us. Of course, we need that. And then the skin is important for temperature regulation. Like, give me an example. Why is the skin important for temperature regulation? When you get to what? Too hot or too cold? When you get too hot or too cold, are you thinking of? Yeah, it's both, but let's just pick one. Let's pick one. Maybe the most obvious one to me is hot. Yeah, you're all familiar with that. So what job does the skin play when you get hot? Yeah, you start to sweat, right? And then that water evaporates, and that takes a lot of energy to evaporate water, to go from a liquid to a gas state, and that cools your body down. It takes that energy, turns it into water vapor, and that cools you down. Of course, also, it's important when you get cold, because see these blood vessels over here? If we look at the picture slide on the right, there are blood vessels right here. When you get cold, blood stops flowing to these blood vessels. Right, and when that happens, then you retain heat in the center part of your body. Core temperature stays the same. Okay, and of course, when you get hot, then these blood vessels open up. A lot of blood comes up over here, delivering a lot of heat to the surface of your body. And then here is a sweat gland. Here's a sweat pore. Sweat goes to the top of the surface of your epidermis, and that cools you down. So both of those, you're exactly right. It's important for cooling and warming. Your skin or your body. Another thing, vitamin D production. Most of natural forms of vitamin D come from a precursor that we have in our diet. That precursor moves up into the skin, and then the ultraviolet light in sun helps convert that inactive form of vitamin D into an active form of vitamin D. So that's pretty important. So if someone were to ask you, is sunlight good or bad for you? What would you have to say? Okay? Yeah, it's one of those things where, oh, you got to be wishy-washy, right? You got to say, well, it's good and bad. It's good, the right amount, because it provides vitamin D for you, but it's damaging to the skin. If you get too much sunlight, that does damage the skin. Okay, and sensation. Skin is also important for sensation. Like, what kind of sensations do you feel on your skin? Pain, yeah. If somebody poked you with a syringe or a pencil or something, you'd probably feel it. You wouldn't like that, right? You'd move away from that stimulus because it's painful, so you can feel pain. What else?
Touch,
yeah. So you can feel touch. You got pressure receptors in the skin. Also, if something just lightly brushes up against you, you have those hair follicles. Those hair follicles can perceive that motion and even wind blowing on your skin. And what about if I put an ice cube on your belly button? Absolutely. You could feel that. Temperature, right? So we communicate to a large degree with our skin, with our environment. It's really important. All right. So let's go from function of skin to some of its structure. Well, I see one and two. There are two main layers in skin. That's where we're going to be mostly interested. But I have number three over here. We talk about number three just because it's so close to the skin. It's not really part of the integumentary system, but it's right there. All right, so the epidermis is the most superficial layer, which means what? It's sitting on the top, right? It's on top of something. And what is it on top of? Epi means on top. It's on top of the dermis, which is the deeper layer. All right, so we got the dermis deep, epidermis that's superficial. And we can see it on this diagram. The epidermis goes from here down to here, and then from here all the way down to here is the dermis. It goes just like that. And then underneath it, all this adipose tissue is not part of the integument. That's part of the hypodermis, right? Hypodermis. So, you know what a hypodermic needle is? It's a needle you'd get a shot with. And where does that inject medications? Not into the epidermis, not into the dermis, but the hypodermis down over here, right? And hence, that's why they call it a hypodermic needle. Okay, there's some newer kinds of needles for various vaccines that are going into the dermis and maybe into the epidermis. Those are nice because then you don't need a big, huge needle jabbing you down into the hypodermis. Okay, so epidermis superficial. And let's take a look at that epidermis in a little bit more detail. Okay, here is a pretty good exam figure. So what we don't see really on this slide is the dermis. We're looking pretty much just at the epidermis. So here is the basement membrane of that epithelium. Here's the apical surface. And so how many layers is that? Okay, but what do we want to call that?
Stratified.
Yeah, I just say stratified. Okay. And what kind of stratified epithelium is it? Squamous, because all of these cells up over here you can tell are flat, right? So it's a stratified squamous epithelium. Okay, and it's four or five layers thick. Like I can see a layer here and a layer here, a layer here and another layer here. We're going to go over that today. So I'm going to come back to that picture in just a second. All right, but this is, all right, the one that I really want to be looking at. All right, so the epidermis has four or five different layers depending on what kind of skin it is. The dermis only has two. Right. See these little projections, these little ripples poking up into the epidermis? These are what we call papillae. And so this layer that's up against the epidermis, we call this the papillary layer. Papillary layer is not very strong. It has some collagen tissues, right, or fibers, maybe some elastic fibers, probably not very much in reticular, right? But it does have some collagen, so it's relatively strong. The layer down over here, we see this is the reticular layer. It's kind of a misnomer because you don't have very many reticular fibers. You have a lot of collagen fibers in this layer. So very few in the papillary, a lot in the reticular. So which layer is stronger, papillary or reticular? Yeah, reticular, because collagen is your strongest fiber. Right. So we said the papillary is areolar connective tissue. The reticular layer is dense, irregular connective tissue, so it's loaded with collagen, but not all in one direction like tendon or ligaments. It's oriented in all kinds of different directions. And as a matter of fact, this is the layer right here that we make leather products from, right, this layer. Because you know shoe leather is really strong, it's just collagen. And all these other tissues have been removed from it because, well, it would be stinky to have all this stuff, hanging on the on your shoes, right? They would rot away eventually. Okay, so that's some of the main features of the skin, right? Just a nice overview. Hypodermis, let's get this out of the way. Not part of the integumentary system. We said that. I see it over here on the slide. It is loose areolar connective tissue. Sometimes we call this superficial fascia. Fascia is a kind of tissue that connects things together. It connects muscles that are next to each other, or muscles next to nerves, next to arteries. All right, so it's a delicate kind of connective tissue, but sort of holds things in place. And the hypodermis, its job, not only is it to store fat that we see in these adipocytes, but its job is to connect the integumentary system to underlying structures. And what might you have down under here? You might have some muscles. You might have some bones. Right? You might even have some arteries. So that's the job of the hypodermis. It just connects, right, the dermis to the rest of your body so it doesn't fall out. All right, this superficial fascia or hypodermis, we can store half of our body fat just in this layer. Right? And as a matter of fact, why is that? Well, you know what the largest organ in your body is? It is your skin. Okay, so there's a huge area right here underneath it, everywhere in your body, to store adipose. Okay, so what's next? Epidermis. All right, let's take a really good view of the epidermis. All right, so epidermis, here's the basement membrane. All right, here is the apical surface, so basal surface, apical surface. And notice these cells on the apical surface are far away from these blood vessels. Right, in these dermal papillae. And as these cells move away farther and farther and farther from these blood vessels, they actually die because they don't get enough oxygen and nutrients. So the living layer, the most living layer, is this basal layer. And the superficial layer is dead. So all the skin cells that we're looking at have been dead for days already. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at the layers of the epidermis. So again, here is the basement membrane. Underneath it would be the dermis. And then here are the layers. We said this first layer right here, this is the living layer. This is the layer that's undergoing mitosis. What does mitosis do for us again? Yeah, it produces daughter cells, right? One parent cell turns into daughter cells, so it's a form of reproduction, but a parent cell by mitosis produces two identical daughter cells, right? So if this produces two identical daughter cells, maybe one moves up over here and then one stays down here, and it doesn't change the stratum basale at all because it's the same cell that gets reproduced. And the stratum basale is about one cell layer thick. Maybe it's two in certain locations. And then it moves up into this layer. And I don't think it's color-coded. It might be, maybe you can see some colors, but I do see some differences in these. So these cells over here kind of look maybe cuboidal. And these cells up over here now approach being squamous. They start to flatten out, but they don't separate from each other because of all these desmosomes that connect the cells together. These are junctions between cells that glue cells together. And as they flatten out, these desmosomes pull on the cell and produce some very sharp edges, some spiky edges, like, oh, I see one there, I see one here. All right, so this layer right above stratum basale is the stratum spinosum. It's stratum spinosum. And then, of course, they get pushed up to the surface in time, and we get to the next layer. And this, it still has some spiky regions right here, but there's something else that appears. I can see some vesicles appearing inside the cells. I see some here. I see some vesicles here. Right, so this is the stratum granulosum because it's easy to see those granules underneath the light microscope. And then they get pushed up to the surface because, remember, these still are dividing. These are still proliferating. Right, proliferation is a process that happens when mitosis is taking place, right? You're building more and more cells. This is the stratum corneum. And these cells are dead, and that just protects this layer of skin. All right, so which layer is the living, growing layer? Stratum basale. That's nice. Let's talk about some other cells. Okay, here is a cell. It's got a bunch of these fingers that are in between other cells, right, in the stratum spinosum.
And it reminded somebody of a nerve cell, but it's not. And that's how it got its name. Dendritic cell, these look like dendrites on a nerve cell, but they're really not. They're just processes coming off. Sometimes this is called a Langerhans cell. Maybe write that down in your book. Langerhans, it's in your textbook. Right, so Langerhans and a dendritic cell are the same, and their function is for immunity. Right, they help fight infection. If something tries to get through your skin to infect your body, these things, or an infection maybe in the skin, then these things can help fight that infection. Okay, there are some bacteria that aren't affected by this dendritic cell, and they're no longer affected by antibiotics. So they're pretty dangerous. Sometimes we can't control that infection in people. Does anybody know what that bacteria is? Yeah, methicillin-resistant streptococcus. Right? And so that can be a really dangerous infection to get. And guess where you find that, mostly? In hospitals, that's right, because one thing they use in hospitals a lot are antibiotics. So antibiotics has produced a strain of bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics, which is another good reason why you shouldn't take an antibiotic unless you really know that it's going to help you. Won't help you with a viral infection. All right, so that's a Langerhans cell. This one also has some processes. Probably looks like a different color than this one. Look at how long these processes are. This is called a melanocyte, and its job is to produce a chemical, which how this cell got its name. It produces melanin, and melanin is a pigment. A pigment is some kind of compound that makes light a certain color. For instance, sunlight, all the light coming from the sun is what we call white light. It has blue and green and orange and yellow. All the colors of the rainbow are mixed in, and to our eyes, that looks like white light. And of course, you know it has all those colors because we can take sunlight and do what? Make a rainbow out of it, right? So it has all those colors. Well, a pigment is a chemical that absorbs some of that energy from the sun, right? But usually not one. So if something looks orange, it's what? Absorbing blue and green, okay? But it's not absorbing the orange color, it's reflecting that back to your eyes, right? And then you see it as an orange color, even though that's not the color that it absorbs. What about these chairs right here? What color are these chairs? They're yellow, right? So there's a pigment in these chairs that absorbs all the colors of the rainbow except yellow. And that yellow gets reflected back and our eyes perceive that as some kind of color. Okay. All right, so the pigment in a melanocyte is black to brown, maybe light brown. And its job, and that's called melanin, that pigment is melanin, and its job is to protect the dermis from sunlight because sunlight is very damaging, especially the ultraviolet parts of sunlight. And so that melanin right here produces a darker color skin, but the darker your skin is, what else happens? The more protected you are from sunlight, right? So that's really a marvelous thing. It acts like a natural sunscreen. And guess what the most damaging thing we can do to our skin? Go out in the sun, right? So people that have a lot of melanin in their skin stays young and youthful for a much longer period of time compared to people that have less melanin because melanin protects them from the sun. All right, what other cell do I see? I see the sensory nerve ending right here. Sometimes we might want to call this a Merkel's disc. This is for very fine touch. All right, so very, very fine touch. You can feel very, very fine sensations on your skin. All right, so make sure you know all the layers and be able to label these skin cells. All right, so they kind of stand out. One cell that I didn't talk about are the names of the cells that make up most of your skin. And they're called keratinocytes. And just like a melanocyte is named after the chemical that it produces, keratinocytes are named after the chemical they produce. And it sounds a lot like collagen, but it's not. It's keratin. And there's a big difference between them. Keratin is a protein, okay, but it is not extracellular like collagen. It is inside the cells. So keratin is an intracellular protein that makes these cells strong. Collagen, of course, goes into the matrix. And you see skin. Does the skin have matrix at all? You're going to say no because it's an epithelium. Epithelium doesn't have a matrix. What kind of tissue does have a matrix? Yeah, connective tissue, right? So here in the dermis, got a lot of matrix in the dermis, both in the papillary and reticular layer, but there's none in the epidermis. All right, so because these cells are loaded with keratin, we call these keratinocytes. And some of these cells actually produce more keratin than your skin cells. Anybody have an idea what kind of, maybe you might find some skin cells that produce even more keratin than what you find on your skin? I'm waiting. Nails, yes. Nails have more keratin in them. Okay, that's why they're harder. And hair is an epidermal cell, and it has more keratin, right? So it's a harder filament. They're just protein cells that kind of line up in columns, right, or lamellae. All right, so keratin is a pretty important particle. These basal cells don't have a lot of keratin, but that's the job of these different layers right here, is to start producing some keratin, and then it's put into these little vesicles, and then it becomes keratin, but it stays inside the cells. All right, these cells also produce like a lipid compound, and it's secreted from these cells, and so there's like a layer of oil between these cells. And guess what job that is doing for us? What did we say up over here? It protects us from dehydration. Where is it? Ah, here, dehydration. All right, so remember, oil and water don't mix. So this is a permeability barrier. Not only are these cells very close together, and they're flat and they're loaded with keratin, but they also have lipid around them. Right, so that prevents us from dehydrating. That's important too. So the skin is performing a lot of functions, right? Melanin protects us, keratin protects us, Langerhans cells protect us from infection. So there's a lot of protection going around, right? Infectious agent. What kind of cell protects us from infections? Langerhans, or you could call that a dendritic cell, right? Okay. So that's sort of what we talked about already. All right, so it resists abrasion. Ah, what is abrasion? You're going to have to Google that, look it up. What is abrasion? I get that question a lot when people are taking a test. What does that mean? You might see it on the test. Okay, so when I say things like that, it usually gets really quiet in the room. People start writing. What does abrasion mean? It means rubbing. Yeah, rubbing, right? So you're riding a motorcycle, you fall off, start sliding along the freeway, that's an abrasion, right? So you're just having skins ripped off the surface of your body. Okay, so this kind of epithelium, this epidermis right here, has so many layers, guess what? You can afford to lose a few of these, like when you put on your clothes, bump up against something, some of these cells rub off because of that abrasion, but that's okay because here's the living layer, it will replace those that get rubbed off, right? So don't forget what abrasion is. But look it up in your dictionary and write a good definition down that makes sense for you what abrasion is. All right, so we look at the layers. We see that the layers go from stratum basale up to the stratum corneum. And is this a one-way arrow or two-way arrow? One-way. So these cells only move in one direction, not two directions. Cornea means cornified cells, which means they're dead and filled with keratin. And it's intracellular. So don't get confused with keratin. And what sort of sounds like keratin, which gives a compound that gives strength, another chemical that gives a lot of strength? You got keratin and what's it? Collagen. Yeah, really strong fiber. Okay. But where do you find collagen? It's extracellular in the matrix. All right. So as the cells move from stratum basale into the corneum, they turn from columnar cells or cuboidal cells to flat cells, right? And again, that's just a one-way arrow. All right, the stratum corneum. If there is a lot of friction in some part of your body, over time, these cells in the basale get activated and produce more and more keratinocytes, and then that will produce a callus in that region of the body. It's just a thicker layer of stratum corneum, and maybe even harder keratin in that area as well. And sometimes when you have a bony prominence, like a bone with a sharp piece sticking up into the dermis, right, and into the epidermis, that produces even more keratinocytes with more keratin, and sometimes we call that a corn. Right, so corns, kind of conical shape, they can be painful because they're brushing up against these tactile cells in the epidermis and other kinds of nerve fibers that are down in the dermis. Okay, so what do we know? Basali, stratum basali, we see right here, has another name. Another name is germinativum, right? And probably we don't hear this term very much in human physiology, but if you study plant physiology, we would use this term a lot, because when this word right here, you want to link up with something in botany. Like what would be happening here? Germination, and what does that mean in terms of botany? That's when a dormant seed turns into a living seed, and it starts to grow. All those cells start to proliferate by mitosis, right? And so this reminded somebody, the stratum basali reminded somebody of when a seed starts to germinate, because these cells are undergoing mitosis, right? And it's always replacing the skin. All right, so we talked about keratinocytes, melanocytes, these Merkel cells or Merkel discs right here. Spinosum, right? Very little mitosis is taking place because that's what happens in the basali. That's where we have the Langerhans. These are macrophages. That means these processes over here can spread out and surround the bacteria and then form a vesicle around it, import the vesicle to the inside of the cell where it is destroyed. It fuses with a lysosome. What's a function of a lysosome? You should know. One word.
Digestion.
Exactly right. Okay. Okay. Granulosum. Right? These are becoming keratinocytes. They produce a compound called keratohyalin granules, right? That's why we see these granules in here. Kind of acts like a glue. It's also important for waterproofing because they also contain a glycolipid. And these cells start to die. Why do these cells start to die in the stratum granulosum? I don't even see a blood vessel on this illustration, right? Number one, epithelium never has a blood vessel, and there's blood vessels way down here in the dermis. They're just moving too far away. Things cannot diffuse through all of these different layers to get to these cells. And as they start to die, the nucleus degenerates. I really don't see a nucleus in any of these. I don't see for sure any in the stratum corneum. So if we were to look at those cells underneath the microscope, we had a chance in lab, but we didn't do it. Right, because those cells are dead, wouldn't even see a nucleus in them. You just see an outline of where the cell was. All right, so that's good for most things of the epidermis. Okay, what good is this glycolipid? What's the function of glycolipid? Yeah, it forms that permeability barrier, right? Lipid, it prevents water from evaporating from your body. Okay, and keratin, is that intracellular or extracellular? Intracellular, because this is not a connective tissue. Okay, so these layers that we just talked about here are in a skin that we call thin skin. Thick skin is a little bit different. Right? It has an additional layer. Let's see if I can find some thick skin. What about that first slide? Didn't have any thick skin. Ah, but here is a really good picture of thick skin. Let me see if there's an illustration. I don't see an illustration, so we're going to work with this one. All right, so if you look at this underneath a microscope, tell me something, what do you recognize right here? There's an important landmark, but you might see a whole bunch of things. What are some things that you see? Okay, I hear some comments, but I can't really hear them. Well, I see a basement membrane right here, which means, what is all this stuff up here? That's an epithelium, all right? And then what kind of epithelium it is? Okay, these look kind of cuboidal, columnar, and they move up over here. These are really flat. So this is a stratified squamous epithelium, right? So that's one thing. And that epithelium has a number of different layers that we can see. Then down below this basement membrane is the dermis. right? And then here's that papillary layer, which is areolar connective tissue, not a lot of collagen. And then down over here is the reticular layer, and look what you see a lot of. A lot of collagen, right? And this one is kind of going right to left. Here's one that's coming in and out of the plane. So these are directed in all different directions. So it gives skin a lot of strength. All right, so here is thick skin. What is one way that I can tell this is thick skin? Well, let's count the layers. Here's stratum basale, right through here, and then spinosum. I can still see some nuclei. And then there's a dark layer right here. And we would see some granules inside these cells. So that's stratum granulosum. But now do you see another really thin layer? See this white line right here? And so here is spinosum granulosum, and the white line is superficial to the granulosum, right? That's the stratum lucidum. Lucidum means clear. Like if somebody's speaking clearly, that means that they're lucid. I meant to ask you the other way around. If somebody is lucid, they're speaking how? Clearly. You can understand them, right? Not a lot of convolutions, not a lot of twists and turns. You can understand what they're talking about. All right, so here's the stratum lucidum. This really bright layer, and then here's the stratum corneum, which is very, very thick. Okay, so this would be an example of thick skin. So don't forget, thick skin has this extra layer, right? Starting with basale, spinosum, granulosum, then lucidum, and then finally corneum. Okay. Yep, the clear layer. Yeah, we talked about all that already. Okay, the dermis. I see some dermis right here. It's dense irregular connective tissue. Down in this region here in the reticular layer, but then this is areolar connective tissue, not quite as strong in the papillary layer. And the strength of this layer comes from all those fibers that are in the matrix, like collagen and elastic fibers. And you should have a lot of elastic fibers in your skin because when you pull on it, it should go back to where it was. All right, and don't forget, is that collagen intra or extracellular? That's extracellular, right? So that just holds skin together, but you can overstretch the skin. Okay, if all of a sudden maybe you gain a lot of weight, okay, and then all of a sudden you lose a lot of weight, maybe in an hour or so, okay, what kind of process is happening there? Like gestation, right? Like maybe somebody's pregnant. And the skin over their abdomen gets stretched and it damages the matrix. It pulls on those collagen fibers, certainly elastic fibers, right? And that damage to the skin are called what? Striae. You might call them something else, but scientifically they're striae, or you might call them stretch marks. Yeah, stretch marks. Okay, these projections up into the epidermis are what we call papillae. And usually there is a plexus of blood vessels. A plexus just means a big network of them. So there's a big network of blood vessels feeding oxygen and other nutrients to all of these cells that line the papillae. But it also kind of pokes up into the epidermis, and so that brings nourishment to these deeper layers of the epidermis as well. All right, so layers, papillary layer, superficial. Yeah, the subpapillary plexus, reticular layer. Okay. So right now, I want to go back to this first slide. All right, here's a good exam figure. So what are some things that you should know about this nice exam figure? Well, I see the two main layers of skin. Starting superficially, what are the two main layers of skin? Epidermis and then dermis. Hypodermis, remember, is not a part of the skin. So here's that basement membrane. All of this is epidermis. Down here is the dermis. But now I see some accessory structures like hair, okay? And I see a little muscle right here. I see a lot of nerve fibers. I see some blood vessels. And then I see these things that have a lot of pockets on them. These are glands. And what's another accessory structure? Oh, look at this. Looks like a nerve cell that's highly specialized, right? This is for sensation. This is for pressure. But it can sense deep pressure that's going all the way through the epidermis, down into the dermis, and sometimes we find these even in the hypodermis. These are what we call Pacinian corpuscles. Pacinian corpuscles, are important for deep pressure. Right? Another name for them, because they have all these layers, are a lamellar corpuscle. But mostly people call them Pacinian corpuscles. You could call them either one that you would like. All right, I see some free nerve endings right here. And these are sensory nerve endings, because when a hair follicle moves, these are the things that are telling you that a hair follicle is moving. Right? You see some other free nerve endings around someplace in here, maybe up over here. These free nerve endings are for temperature sensation, for cold and hot. And these free nerve endings are also there for pain. Right? So they're pain fibers, or cold fibers, hot fibers, all those kinds of things. And then we need some nerve fibers to innervate this muscle. Now, this muscle right here, you do not have voluntary control of. Right? So can anybody remember the three kinds of, oh, I told you, three kinds of muscle cells that you have in your body? What are the three kinds? Skeletal, I like that. Cardiac, and smooth. Yeah, if you remember them in that order, that's fine with me. Okay. So you know skeletal muscle is attached to your skeleton. So here's a muscle. Is it attached to a skeleton? No. So would you guess this is skeletal muscle? No, I wouldn't guess this is skeletal muscle. All right, skeletal muscle is under voluntary control. What about cardiac and smooth? Involuntary. So this one is controlled involuntarily. You don't have control of this one. All right, so these are autonomic nerves that go to this one. And this one, of course, it's not cardiac muscle either, because it's not your heart. Right, so this is smooth muscle. All right, so this one can contract. It can pull on this hair follicle and pull it up to the surface, all right? But something else is happening here too. Usually we have the smooth muscle. It's called an arrector pili. Arrector pili is on one side. So that when it pulls, it will pull a hair follicle from a lying down position. If you pull on one end, it's also going to stand up like that. Okay, and since the other end of the muscle is connected to the epidermis, it's going to pull that hair follicle up. So it's going to stand it up, pull it up to the surface, and that produces a little welt right here, and commonly we would call that a goosebump, right? When you're cold or other kinds of emotional stimulus that activate your autonomic nervous system cause this muscle here to contract. Okay, so that produces a goosebump. I see blood vessels, no blood vessels in the epidermis here. I see some in this dermal papillae, right here and here. That's the subpapillary vascular plexus. So that's just a network of blood vessels and capillaries that can release nutrients to this whole area as well as the dermis, right? That's where these cells in the stratum basale get their energy from. All right, so that's pretty good for nerve endings, but don't forget, we got those Merkel's discs up here. They're not drawn on this slide. There's other ones called Meissner's corpuscles. Kind of look like a Pacinian corpuscle, but they're a little bit smaller. They're closer to the surface as well. The models that we have in lab show those. All right, so those are important sensory receptors. Now, something else you might see. All right, we talked about all these little bulbous structures. These are glands. Ooh, what kind of tissue makes glands? Can anybody remember what kind of tissue makes glands? What do you got for? You got epidermis? No. Epithelium? You got epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, and nervous tissue. So it's got to be one of those four. Yeah, epithelium makes glands. All right, that's going to be important in a little bit. So here's some epithelium down over here that's been converted into a gland, and it secretes onto this hair follicle. Okay, and it acts like a lubricant, so this hair follicle can actually move right from this area where it's growing to the surface of your skin. And that chemical is called sebum, so this is a sebaceous gland. Right, and sebaceous glands probably have a little antibacterial agent in them as well, so it protects against infection. Right, not only lubricates this hair follicle, but it lubricates and protects the surface of the skin as well. All right, so That's an oil gland. I see another gland right here. We're going to call this an eccrine sweat gland. It produces sweat. And again, it's made out of epithelium. It produces sweat, which comes up here to the surface, which then helps cool you down. There's another kind not shown on this slide, so I probably won't talk about it. This is an eccrine. There's also an apocrine gland. Apocrine glands are probably maybe 5 or 10 times the size of this eccrine sweat gland, and those you find definitely down in the dermis, maybe in the hypodermis a little bit, but way down deep. Those apocrine glands we find in pretty much only two locations, and that is the axillary region. Ooh, where's that?
Armpit.
Yeah, axillary region and inguinal region. All right, and so they secrete not just water, but also an organic compound, and that organic compound all by itself is not odoriferous, but it can be used as an energy source for bacteria, and when those bacteria digest it, then they leave a little odor as well. So depending on the kinds of bacteria that are around that area will produce different smells. And there's a nice hypothesis, probably not a theory yet, but a hypothesis that says that we are attracted to each other, all right, by the smells of these compounds, and maybe help regulate different things inside our body. So they work like hormones going from one person to another person. All right, and that's called a pheromone. All right, that's certainly not proven yet, but there probably is a lot of evidence that pheromones do exist for human species, and we just haven't really found out what these are yet. All right, and one really good example, plants use pheromones a lot. Animals use pheromones. Insects use pheromones. A really good example in human population, well, when you went to college years ago, like my age, the guys would be in one dorm and the gals would be in another dorm, right? They were segregated that way. And when all the women would come to campus in the fall, their cycle, right, their periodic cycle, menstrual cycle, would be all over the place. Some would have menstrual cycles in the beginning, some in the middle, some at the end of the month, right? But after living together for a couple months, guess what happens? All the women start to cycle together, okay? And so that is some indirect evidence that there are pheromones, something controlling our reproductive system. That's sort of interesting that that happens. But there could be other reasons why. But we don't want to talk about that too much. Okay, but that's the apocrine gland, right? Secretes an organic substance, and depending on what bacteria are there, it produces different kinds of odors in different kinds of people. Okay, sebaceous glands, sweat glands, apocrine glands, that's a whole lot of glands that we have talked about. Okay, what about questions? Anybody have any questions right at the moment so far? Questions? Doing pretty good? All right, so you just got to memorize those layers. Is this the first time we've taken a look at layers? Well, not really, right? In the tissue chapter, we looked at layers of epithelium, right? There it was really easy because either it was simple or stratified. In other tissues, it's a little bit more complicated. Like you have either four or five layers in this epidermis. But it's really important to understand what these layers are doing, right? It's just not an exercise in memorization because that is where disease takes place, within these different layers. So when a pathologist looks at these layers, right, he's able to diagnose what kind of problem it is. Maybe it's some kind of cancer, right? And by what layers it in, they can determine, they can stage that particular cancer, right? So those are important diagnostic tests that can be done by looking at these different layers. And also, when we talk about burns, it's also important to know these layers, right? Well, if you can come up with a diagnosis of some pathology, then what does that lend itself to? If you can't diagnose a problem, certainly you can't treat it, right? But if you can diagnose something that's going on, then you can use all your knowledge and databases, what, to come up with a therapy, right, to deal with that kind of pathology, right? So knowing what layers are involved are very important. So we're going to look at a lot of layers in anatomy. Okay. So make sure you know these different layers. Well, you know, we all have different skin color. Why is that? Well, we have pigments, right? And pigments are just chemicals that reflect a certain color light but absorb other colors, right? So we all have different colors. There is one kind of person, let's go down to E, okay, that has an abnormal condition. It's not a disease condition, but it is abnormal because there just aren't very many in our population, right? And that person won't be able to produce any melanin whatsoever. So all those melanocytes are maybe producing a compound, but it's not very dark. Right, so that person has a condition that we call albinism. So what would they look like? If you can't produce any melanin in your body, what is your hair going to look like? White. What are your nails going to look like? Kind of white, but if you look, you can actually look through them and see blood underneath them, so they're going to look, of course you're trusting me to tell you this, they look pink, okay? And skin, very, very white, right? But not white all over the place, it could be pink too if there's superficial blood vessels, right? So they're going to look just like their parents, right? Except that they won't be able to produce melanin. They'll have similar kinds of facial features and hair features and everything else, but they'll just be pretty much white all over the place. Well, that individual is at a disadvantage. Why is that? What's their disadvantage?
They're vulnerable.
They're vulnerable to what? What is a melanocyte doing? Melanocyte is producing melanin. It protects you from ultraviolet light, right? So somebody with albinism is very sensitive to sunlight. In the summertime, if they go outside with unprotected skin, they can have their skin burned in maybe a minute, maybe less than a minute, right? So that's the importance of that melanin. So there probably aren't very many people with albinisms or albinism in you don't have many of them, you just have one, right? There's no such thing as albinisms. Sorry about that. Albinism in Southern California, right? Because the sun is just too bright. Where would you maybe find a population of somebody with albinism?
Siberia.
I have to look on a map. I think I sort of know where Siberia is, but I don't have a really clear picture. But someplace that's far north, right? Siberia might be far north. I'm not too sure. But in the United States, if I was going to go to a northern city, I would go to? Well, Alaska, yeah, like Anchorage for sure. Okay, because in the wintertime, they don't have any sun at all. Okay, now you might not like that, so maybe not Anchorage. But so let's think of something a little bit south where you have more seasonal variation. Well, maybe like Seattle, okay, where the sun isn't really bright. And so they would have an easier time there. Nonetheless, even though all of us have melanocytes producing melanin, what should we do when we go out in the sun? Okay, we should wear a hat, okay? Protect our nose and the tops of our ears and sunscreen, for sure. Maybe long sleeve shirts, just to protect yourself from the sun. Okay. All right, so that's pigments. So the other thing you can see through the epidermis, if you don't have a lot of melanin, are these blood vessels, right? So that skin is going to look kind of pink under certain conditions. All right, so what else? Melanocytes, well, we talked about that. Mostly you find them in the stratum basale. Moles and age spots are an increased number of melanocytes in some little location on your body, so you just have a little bit darker area. Freckles are an increased melanin production in a localized area. They're sort of like moles and age spots. Okay, but moles are increased number of cells. Freckles are due to a little hyperactivity of the cells that are there. You have the same number of melanocytes. All right, albinism we talked about. What about cyanosis? All right, this is hugely important. Okay, so I see a couple of blood vessels here. I see a red one and a blue one. And I don't know, could you tell me what kind of blood vessels these are? And I'll give you a little bit of a hint. There could be veins or there could be arteries. These two blood vessels, one is a vein, one is an artery. Yeah. So here is that red one. This red one has a lot of oxygen in it. It binds to hemoglobin, which has a pigment, and that pigment then turns red when oxygen is bound to it. All right? And if you look through the skin, then maybe that really light red color will turn out to be a pink color. All right, but what about this one here? This is a vein. It's blue because oxygen has left the blood to give oxygen to all of these tissues, and then hemoglobin is no longer bright red, kind of a dull red, maybe a bluish kind of red, right? But again, don't ask me for exactly what kind of color it is. All right. So, for instance, if we don't have a lot of oxygenated blood going to the skin, right? If this vessel right here doesn't have oxygen in it, what color will it turn? It'll turn blue, just like this one over here. All right, so now instead of having pink color skin, what color skin are you going to have?
Blue.
You're going to have blue color skin. And that's what we call cyanosis. All right, now, can you imagine what that's like? to be cyanotic, what are these tissues starving for? Oxygen. Yeah, oxygen. These cells can't make ATP, so they're slowly dying. Right? So that's one of the first things that we look at in somebody that's born, is what color their skin is. And it goes into other things that are measured, like reflexes and things like that. It goes into a score called an Apgar score. Maybe some of you have heard of that Apgar score. And cyanosis is one of those conditions. And that usually is a result of some malformation of the heart or great vessels coming off the heart. And that means their blood isn't going to their lungs, being oxygenated, and being delivered to the rest of their tissues. All right, so the structure of their heart or the structure of blood vessels coming off the heart has changed, which means what? The function of those blood vessels has changed, right? So now we have deoxygenated blood here, and somebody looks cyanotic. And what do you think we should do with somebody like that? Slap them? Well, they should start breathing for sure, okay? But we want to help them out. What's the first step in helping somebody out? What's first? Anatomy or physiology? Anatomy always comes first. So we want to see what's happening in that heart. What's happening in those blood vessels? What are they connected to? Are they connected up inappropriately? Are they in the right spot or not? So somebody that's born with cyanosis, guess what somebody yells for right away? Yeah, oxygen, that will help relieve the symptoms a little bit. But we want a scan of the mediastinum. Lungs would be pretty good, but mediastinum is that space where? Right between the lungs that has the heart and blood vessels, right? So we want to look at that structure immediately to try to understand what's happening with this pathophysiology. So that's really important. So you got to know that mediastinum. We talk about it a lot because it contains the heart and great blood vessels. Very important structures. All right. And then once you know the structure and where it's abnormal, then you have a chance at, so then you've diagnosed the problem, then you can figure out what to do with that problem, right? Okay. Another condition, jaundice. Okay. Yeah, jaundice is a condition. Again, this, it's a chemical. It's transported in the blood. And it's a bright yellow color, a lot brighter than this pectinine corpuscle and these adipocytes over here. It's produced by a chemical called bilirubin, even though rubin means red. Okay, it's a yellow color. And jaundice could be due in for a couple of different reasons. The liver is important in detoxifying a number of compounds. And when you lose liver function, bilirubin will build up inside the body, and it's what? It's a pigment. And so then your skin will turn yellow, your nails will turn yellow, the whites of your eyes turn yellow, right? But a really kind of striking yellow condition. All right, so what could that be? What could affect liver function? Well, yeah, hepatitis, that's a really good cause, right? That's an infection of, anytime you hear hepo or hepo, hepa, you should think of liver, right? So hepatitis, inflammation of the liver, maybe cirrhosis of the liver due to alcoholism or obesity, oof, all these kinds of things can produce that. Okay, I'm going to get the baby. We're going to get the baby. No, that's good that you reminded me because I got carried away with adults. But how else could adults? Maybe cancer of the liver, right? So cirrhosis of the liver has a tendency to go into cancer. But if you're taking chemotherapy for a cancer somewhere else in the body, it might also damage the liver. And a side effect of that chemotherapy would be jaundice, right? We wouldn't like to see that, but that happens sometimes. Okay, might end up with needing a liver transplant as well. All right, so that's for an adult or adolescent, but in the newborn, that's also important, like cyanosis. Okay, so that goes into their Apgar score because bilirubin comes from hemoglobin that is in all these red blood cells. All right, so heme is a part of hemoglobin, and it is detoxified into bilirubin and it's excreted from your body. And bilirubin is not too toxic for adults, but it's very toxic for a newborn, because their nervous system is still developing. And even in utero, their nervous system is developing. So jaundices will inhibit the growth of their brain, maturation of their brain, and all the other nerves in their body. All right, so that jaundice is due to breakdown of too many red blood cells. So many red blood cells are being broken down that heme can't be processed by the liver. because it's just overloaded. It's doing its job, but it can't get rid enough of that bilirubin. Well, what is the condition that breaks down red blood cells very fast? And that's called, it's got two names, erythroblastosis fetalis, right? And that just means breakdown of all these blood cells in a fetus is what that comes from, or it's called hemolytic disease of the newborn. That's probably a more reasonable term to remember. Hemolytic means red blood cells are breaking down of the newborn, right? And that produces jaundice. Well, why are there red blood cells breaking down? And that's because there's a mismatch in blood types between the fetus and the mother, right? It's not in the ABO blood system, but it's in the Rh factor. So if the mom is Rh negative and the baby happens to be Rh positive, then the mom can produce antibodies against that Rh antigen, which is on the surface of all these cells, and then it starts to destroy the cells of their fetus. Right? Fortunately, not a whole lot of cells, but enough damage is done on these erythrocytes. Ooh, what's an erythrocyte? Yeah, red blood cell. Okay. All right, so how is it possible that the mom could be Rh negative and her baby Rh positive, right? How can the mom be negative and the baby be positive? What would be your guess? The father is positive. That's right. If the father's positive, then the baby has a 50-50 chance of being negative or positive, right? So that's why years ago you had to have a blood test when you got married just to see if that ever was going to be a problem. And I don't think now we require a blood test for anybody, okay? And, of course, you don't have to be married to have a baby anyway, right? You don't need a license. So it's easily diagnosed early on, and probably with good prenatal care, that possibility is sought out first. And it's easy to treat if we know that. All right, so that's cyanosis, jaundice. Birthmarks in the dermis, way down over here. That's just an increased area where we have more blood vessels. All right, so it's going to look reddish, perhaps, or maybe a darker pink color. All right, and that's what we call a birthmark. Okay. Yeah.
Birthmarks have nothing to do with
melanin. Yep. They should be more, I think they should be more of a red color than a brown or black color. But if you have an area that has a lot more oxygen and nutrients than normal, guess what's going to happen to those melanocytes? They'll probably be a little bit more active, right, because they have plenty of nutrients and oxygen. So some birthmarks might not just be pure red, okay? But mostly it's because of blood vessels. Okay, so remember, those blood vessels are important for bringing nutrients up into the skin. Yeah, we can't really, because melanin is produced by these melanocytes. Those melanocytes are there, and that's controlled by our heredity, right? So we can't really change them because we can't change our chromosomes or genes in our body. But that would be a nice way to, yeah, if you're going to live in the tropics, to somehow modify these melanocytes so they would produce more melanin for you. That would be really nice. Gene therapy is just a beginning science, a beginning clinical modality, but it's going to be very powerful because you'll be able to convert certain cells into other cells, especially a cancer cell back to a normal cell. That would be wonderful if gene therapy could get to that level. But we're just not that familiar with how things are controlled on chromosomes in people. But some people are getting pretty close with gene therapy. Yeah, so that's really one nice question. Look forward to that. Okay, accessory structures. What did we say accessory structures were? Hair, muscle, glands, okay, and nails. All right, so what's the first thing? Hair. Okay, let's go look at some hair. Well, here I see a hair. Okay. Where's a better picture of hair? Well, I see a nail. Here's a pretty good picture of a hair. Okay, so of course you know this layer. What is this layer? One of the two. This is the epidermis, right? And then here's the dermis. And here we have, of the epidermis, what is this first layer here? The germinativum, the one that's proliferating, the one that's growing. Stratum basale. All right, so trace it around. Where does that stratum basale go? Is it stuck up all the time? Oh, it makes a deep dive down over here, way down into the dermis. All right, so, and this is another reason why we want to know something about layers, not necessarily for hair, but eventually we're going to talk about it. This layer, or this part of the hair, is what we call the bulb. And this is the part that's growing the most. Right? And then those cells get pushed up into the root. Here's the hair root. And when it goes up to the surface, that becomes the shaft of a hair. All right, so what do we see? Well, this is not an exam figure, okay? But here I see the cortex of this hair, right? And then here is part of the cuticle. This is a growing region. Then here is the medulla. So what's the deepest part of a hair called? It's the medulla. And a more superficial part is the cortex. Okay, cortex. The cuticle is kind of a special structure all by itself. All right, so that's something that we're going to use a lot in this class, right? If we have an organ, the deep part is always going to be called the medulla, and the superficial part is going to be called the cortex, like adrenal medulla, adrenal cortex. There's other kinds that I can't think of right at the moment. All right, so here are the cells that are dividing, and there might be melanocytes in here, and what do these melanocytes do? They produce melanin, right? Produces hair color, dark, not so dark, all depends on the kind and the amount of melanin. All right, so here is, this is a follicle. The bulb is here, the root is here, the shaft is above the surface of the skin. All right, and then also attached to this hair follicle, of course, is that arrector pili muscle, and that epithelium also makes a sebaceous gland on this hair follicle, and it secretes what? Sebum, right, to this hair root right here. Okay. All right, so here we have a plexus of blood vessels that can nourish all of these cells. This is like what? The stratum basale of your epidermis. And then here we have melanocytes that produce melanin in this hair bulb. And again, these are just epidermal cells. And these epidermal cells grow out from the bulb in columns or sheets. And that's what forms that hair that's coming out of our skin. It looks a lot different, but it's really the same kind of cell. So these things are called keratinocytes, right? Because they're loaded with keratin. They're just in a little bit different form. Okay. Muscle. Muscle, arrector pili, you know that's a smooth muscle. You don't have control of it. And of course, it's not cardiac muscle that can produce goosebumps under certain locations. Glands in the skin. We got sebaceous glands. Where do you always find a sebaceous gland? On a hair follicle. That's the only place where we find it. Okay. And it secretes sebum with what we call a holocrine secretion. That means whole cells break away. Right, so these cells produce an oily compound, and a whole cell breaks away from the surface of that epithelium, right, and it degrades, breaks apart, and that becomes sebum inside the cell. That lubricates the skin, prevents dehydration, and protects against some bacterial infection. So some of those compounds are not really antibiotics, but they're bacteriostatic agents. They just prevent the growing of bacteria. Okay, regular kinds of sweat glands. Right, we call the sudoriferous glands. We got a couple different kinds. We talked about eccrine. These are the normal kinds of sweat glands. Some people call these merocrine glands, but you can call them eccrine glands in here. And they secrete water and some salt to the surface of the skin. And what do they do there? What does that water do there? It cools you down, right? That's for thermoregulation. And there's some salts in there, so that changes how electricity goes over the surface of your skin. So if you put certain kinds of electrodes on your skin, you can tell how much somebody is perspiring. How many salts is this person secreting onto their skin? And sometimes that's used in a lie detector test, right? And it works for some people. If they tell a lie, that activates their autonomic nervous system and it causes more secretion of sweat onto their skin, and that increases the electrical conductivity on the surface of their skin. Right? So a skilled person might be able to tell. But if somebody doesn't know right from wrong or doesn't care right from wrong, then it's a useless test to perform. And so it's not too useful. Okay, apocrine. We talked about that. That's in the axilla, genital. Oh, external ear. Okay, that's nice. It secretes a thick organic solution, right, and that produces body odor. And, of course, that organic secretion can be worked on, can be used as an energy source by these bacteria. Somebody just asked me a question, okay, because you don't want carrots growing in your ears or around your ears. Your mom ever tell you that? So wash where? Behind your ears. And I forgot about it. Somebody asked me. I said, I don't know of any gland right there. But here is an apocrine gland. All right, secretes kind of an oily substance. All right, and of course, you have to wash that area, right, to get rid of those extra oils. Usually when you think of ear, you think of ceruminous gland. A ceruminous gland you find in the external acoustic meatus. Have you all heard of what the external acoustic meatus is? Yeah, you got a quiz this week on that, right, from the bones. All right, so that's part of your outer ear, but that's how sound energy enters your ear. And you have a very thin membrane that vibrates back and forth when sound energy hits it. Okay, and we don't want that membrane to dry out. We don't want it to get brittle. So there are some sweat glands that secrete cerumen into that canal and onto the eardrum. And that's really called a tympanic membrane, so that it can vibrate back and forth. Okay, and so cerumen is a lubricant, but it also helps fight infection because there's all kinds of bacteria that get in there. And what organ are those bacteria really close to if they get in there? Your brain, right? So you gotta protect your brain. Any decrease in brain function, okay, could be fatal, right? And so that would be an encephalitis of some kind. So that cerumen in your external auditory meatus is pretty important from that standpoint. That's earwax, yeah. So it's an oily, waxy, it's an oil. Wax is sort of like an oil, but it's a longer molecule. So it tends to turn into a solid more than stay a liquid. Right, so wax is like that. Mammary glands are modified sweat glands. Okay, and those glandular tissues produce milk under certain circumstances. Okay. Nails. Let's take a look at some nails. I think you have an exam figure for nails. Okay, you do. Right here. All right, so here is the tip of a digit. Ooh, what's a digit? It's a finger, yeah. So I got five digits here, five digits there, right? And here is the distal end of that digit. Protecting that distal end is a nail. And these are all keratinocytes loaded with keratin. All right, so here is the free edge of that nail. And here is just some free space. Here's the body of a nail. Sometimes you can see a special layer underneath the nail right here. We call that the lanula. And then the cuticle, right? Sometimes we call that the epinicium. And then down over here, underneath this nail fold, proximal nail fold, right, I see some of that growing epidermis, and that's what we call the matrix. All right, so where do plants usually grow from? Hopefully you haven't taken a botany class, but usually I would say it grows from the root, right, that's in the ground. Well, a nail does not grow from the root. Here is the root of the nail, right? It's underneath this proximal nail fold. But these cells are already dead right here, right? You got to go all the way to the stratum basale. So there's nice layers here that are undergoing mitosis, and that's what we call the nail matrix. So a nail grows from the nail matrix, not the root, which is kind of that can lead students astray. Okay, and then here's that nail bed, and this region right here has a little bit different color that produces that lanula. And then here is, you recognize this thing right here? We haven't really studied this very much, but this is a bone, yeah. And then here is compact bone, here's some spongy bone. Bones that make up your digits are called phalanges. And so here is a phalanx. One is a phalanx. If you have a bunch of them, like in this digit right here, there are three, so there are three phalanges. All right, so this is a pretty good exam figure to know as well. All right, there's one last thing that I want to talk about, and that is burns to the skin. All right, and it has something to do with layers. So I'm going to really zoom out. Okay, so here, there are different kinds of burns, right? First degree, second degree, third degree, maybe some even more than that. And of course, if you burn your skin, what are some of the problems? Dehydration, infection, right? Because that's one of the first things that skin does. All right, so what layer that I see right here is responsible for regeneration of epidermis when it's damaged? Stratum basale, right? So here's the stratum basale right there, right? That's clearly seen. All right, so when you get a burn, you irritate, this area starts to swell up, these nerve fibers are irritated, right? These blood vessels here slightly swollen so it looks red. None of these cells are actually burned, right? But they're temperature damaged because the temperature has been too high, right? That's what we call a first degree burn. And is that person lucky or not so lucky? That's a really lucky person, right? Because these epidermal cells haven't been killed, so what can they do? Replace any kind of damage that's happened in this layer right up over here. Right? Swelling goes down, these blood vessels heal up. And what is a second degree burn? What's happening? Well, again, some of these cells really haven't been burned up to charcoal just yet, but maybe some of them have been killed. Right? And these cells are really irritated, and even cells down in the dermis are irritated. So these blood vessels that are there in the subpapillary plexus become very leaky. They leak a lot of plasma, right? And that fluid then forms a blister underneath the skin. That's an example of a second degree burn. And more of these nerves are damaged, so it hurts a little bit more. But now, is that person lucky or not so lucky? That person is still lucky, right? Because these cells in the stratum basale are still alive, right? And they can replace all these cells that have been damaged. All right. Third degree burn is when these cells completely burn away from the skin, all the way down past the stratum basale, maybe into the dermis, and maybe deep down into the dermis. Let's just say this layer right here where the cursor is moving back and forth. All right. A third degree burn down to this layer. Is that person lucky or not lucky? Okay. I think that person is still lucky. Okay. For the following reason. Look at the stratum basale, right? This is the growing region. And we said that the cells were damaged or killed down to there. Where does that stratum basale go? All the way deep down here. So sometimes we call a hair follicle a reservoir of living epidermal cells, right? Or stratum basale. And the reason why I said that person is lucky because they still have areas, pockets all over their skin where what can happen? It can grow back, okay? So that patient with a third degree burn is still, in my opinion, kind of lucky, right? Because their skin will grow back. All right, now what about if you get a third degree burn all the way down to here? Oh, now you're really unlucky because now you need to get skin from another part of your body, somebody else, an animal in the meantime so you don't dehydrate. All right, so that's a really damaging third degree burn. All right, so that illustrates how important it is to know layers and where they go. Right, because that determines the kind of pathology and what kind of treatment and regeneration of these tissues is possible. Okay, sign-in sheet was going around, right? Did I pass it out? Good. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And next time, be prepared for a bone chapter.